Franz stuck behind a bush and froze, barely daring to breathe, waiting for the guards to pass.
"Wolfgang," one of the soldiers said, "did you hear something just now?"
"Ah, it's just a rabbit, man. Don't be so jumpy."
They passed on. Franz waited for a few minutes, then grabbed the barrel of his revolver and hurled it into the nearby lake. The splash sounded deafening. The guards raced back and stopped within an arm's length of Franz, where he lay behind his bush.
"Who goes there?"
After a brief silence, the other guard chuckled.
"Yeah, it must have been the fish jumping. I don't know, I thought I heard something just now."
Franz lay behind his bush, perfectly still, hardly daring to breathe. He knew that if he was caught, it would probably mean his life. But he knew that when the time came to choose between his own life and the eternal soul across the battlefield, his expert marksmanship skills would probably betray him. It would be better to enter the battle unarmed than to take that risk. At the age of 40, Franz Hassel was drafted into the army of Hitler's Germany and forced to serve in the Pioneer Company 699, who were tasked with going ahead of the advancing Wehrmacht and to build bridges. So he was ahead of the front lines. But as a Seventh-day Adventist, Franz was faced with numerous challenges to his convictions. Most obvious was his belief in the sanctity of human life. Also was his belief in the refusal of pork, which happened to be a staple in the German military. And finally was the keeping of the Sabbath. And the Third Reich, determined to create a European empire, had no sympathy for any of these. But someone bigger than the Third Reich was calling the shots. For out of the 1,200 original corpsmen in the 699, only 7 survived the war. Making literal Psalm 91, 1,000 shall fall at thy side and 10,000 at thy right hand, but it shall not come nigh thee. Also giving the title to this book, 1,000 shall fall. The book alternates between Franz Hassel on the Eastern Front and his wife Helena back in Frankfurt with their 4 children. They were facing their own set of pressures with the strong encouragement and threat, trying to get them to join the Nazi party, as well as the Third Reich required children to go to school 6 days a week. You can make them smarter that way, which forced them to go to school on Saturday, which was an issue for them. Also was the simple challenge of getting food and surviving bomb raids in a war. Not to mention delivering a baby between bomb raids. Her name was Susie. She grew up to be the author of this book, so it's Susie Mundi. The myriad of crises throughout this book and the alternating format between Franz and Helena made this a favorite of mine for story last year, or it's simply a good soul-stirring read of one desperate family choosing to be faithful, regardless of the cost, and finding refuge in the shadow of the Almighty. I guess you have extra time.
I'd be glad to take it.
Some of you may have heard of Ben Carson. He was one of the world's most brilliant surgeons, not just any surgeon. He was a brain surgeon. One of his patients, a 4-year-old girl named Miranda, was suffering from a terrible affliction. Her body was racked by seizures, sometimes as many as 100 in a day. Her parents had tried everything. All other doctors had given up hope. Her condition would lead to permanent paralysis on one side of her body, then mental retardation, then death. Then someone referred them to Dr. Carson. After carefully studying her records, he realized that her only hope was a hemispherectomy. That means removing the infected half of her brain that was causing the seizures. He had never done one before, but he knew it was their only chance. Other doctors had used this procedure, but they had given up on it because it was causing so many fatalities. But Dr. Carson decided to try it. Before he left the hospital on the evening of the surgery, he told her parents to say their prayers. He was very anxious. He finally gave it over to God, saying, "If she dies, she dies. But at least we'll know we did the best we could for her." But did you know that this incredibly brilliant brain surgeon was once a class dummy? In fifth grade, he was at the bottom of his class. Once, after a quiz with 30 problems, he was disgusted with himself as he saw a big fat zero at the top of his paper, again. When the teacher called his name, he mumbled, "Num, 9, Benjamin, how wonderful!" She kept on raving until the girl behind him informed the teacher that he had said none. Everyone burst out laughing at him. So how did he end up being a brain surgeon? Of course, it wasn't his fault. He didn't have a chance. His father left home when he was 8 years old. His mother had to work all the time and was barely able to provide for them. Incidentally, his mother got married at 13 years old to his dad, who was 28 years old. He didn't have a chance. She was under such stress that she worked herself into a... She checked herself into a mental institution from time to time. Sometimes for several weeks. She told the boys, "I'm going to go visit relatives." And she would go check herself in, and then the neighbors would help take care of the children while she was gone. He also had to overcome a terrible temper. Once he got so angry with his friend, he lunged at his friend with a big camping knife. Find out what happened in this book. This book, the one that's up in the air or somewhere in Texas or Portland, or I'm not sure where it's at. This book, Gifted Hands, the Ben Carson story, tells about his amazing journey from poverty to riches. From being the class dummy in fifth grade to the top of his class in seventh grade. 2 years later, what in the world happened? Bottom of his class in fifth grade, top of his class in seventh grade. He went on to win a scholarship, a 90% scholarship. That means they paid 90% of his tuitions to Yale University, which is an incredibly top, high-up university. Even then, he had to work hard. He went there thinking that, wow, they should be glad that I'm coming to their school. And he got there and he sat down for lunch at the cafeteria one of the first days and started talking. And they started talking about their SAT scores. And he found out that everyone else at the table had scored better than he had. And that kind of made him think. But he didn't work very hard the first few weeks of college. And at the end of that semester, he knew he was failing in chemistry. He didn't have a chance. There was no way he was going to pass. He studied and crammed and crammed. And finally, the night before, he was just at his wit's end. He prayed. He said, "God, please." His dream was to be a doctor when he grew up. And he knew if he failed his chemistry class, they would kick him out of pre-med school. So he prayed, "God, please help me." Find out how God answered his prayers through a dream he had that night. God definitely had a plan for him. Once he was traveling with his girlfriend at the time, and she was sleeping, and he was driving 90 miles an hour, I'm not sure why, down the interstate, and he fell asleep. And God spared him. Read the book to find out how. Back to Miranda, the girl that was having seizures. After 10 hours of surgery, he successfully removed half of her brain. And you know, you could live without half your brain. She recovered to live an almost normal life with no more seizures. In fact, before the surgery, they asked her, they said, you know, because she was dying. They said, "You know, is there anything you would like to have?" And she said, "No more seizures." Only 4 years old. After surgery, they were wheeling her out of the operating room. Her parents were frantically waiting in the waiting room. And they heard her coming out. They ran over to her. And she kind of opened her eyes a little bit and said, "I love you, Mommy." And he realized that the surgery was successful. She could talk. She could move. They didn't know what was going to happen, but she recovered almost fully. His most famous surgery involved two boys who were Siamese twins. They were both joined at the head from birth. And he was able to... No, you have to read the book to find out. One time when he was about to do brain surgery on a little girl, her grandmother asked, "Dr. Carson, have you ever done one of these before?" "No, not really," he said with a straight face. "But I know how to read fairly well, and I own a lot of medical books, and I take most of them with me into the operating room." This book will show you that no matter who you are, what color your skin is, or where you come from, how much money your family has, you can be successful. He says, and I don't have the book here, but he says something about when he was growing up, his mother had a thing that she would tell him. Whenever he would come to her with excuses, I can't do this, it's too hard, I can't do it. She would say, do you have a brain? And he realized, well, yeah. Well, then you can do it. If you have a brain, you can do it. Your students come to you and say, I can't do this math. Do you have a brain? God gave each one of us an incredible tool to use. Again, this is Gifted Hands, the Ben Carson story, copyright 2009 by Greg Lewis and Deborah Shaw Lewis. You can find it at almost any half-price bookstore online. This book had me crying through some heartbreaking moments and laughing at his humorous responses. You will love it. You need to read it.
Then there's nothing left for us to do but fight, I said. I've come to teach this school and I'm going to teach it. Maybe you will, he snarled. I have you penned in this schoolhouse. I have you where I want you. You can't get away. You can't run. I aim to whip you right where you stand. It's the same place I whipped your sister. I looked at his face. It was red as a sliced beet. Fire danced in his pale blue eyes. I knew Guy Hawkins meant every word he said. I knew I had to face him and to fight. There was no other way around. I had to think quickly. How would I fight him? Will you let me take my necktie off? I asked, remembering I'd been choked by a fellow pulling my necktie once. Yep, take off that pretty tie, he said. You might get it dirty by the time I'm through with you. I slowly took my tie off. Roll up the sleeves of your white shirt, too, he said. But they'll be dirty by the time I sweep this floor up with you. Sweep the floor up with me, I said. He shot out his long arm, but I ducked. I felt the wind from his thrust against my ear. I mustn't let him clinch me, I thought. The thread that runs so true, written by Jesse Stewart, a school teacher in the 1920s, began his teaching career at about 17 years of age in the state of Kentucky. He teaches school, grades 1 to 8, with about 35 students. During the wintertime, his attendance would swell up to around 60. He has 54 classes to teach in 6 hours, and some of his students have been in the first grade for 8 years. His older students are older than he is. After the fight that I referred to in the introduction, Guy Hawkins commented, Mr. Stewart, I really got it poured on me, but you winned fair. News of this fight speeds across the valley and, believe it or not, gains the needed respect for the new teacher. Jesse shows an old gentleman of the valley how to measure coal, how much coal his wagon holds, and the gent, out of the goodness of his heart, sets him up for a date with a teacher from the upper valley. And I guess you'll have to read to kind of see how that worked out. Jesse takes upon himself to repaint the entire schoolhouse. Guy Hawkins and his cronies show up to help him because now he has their respect. After repainting the school, Jesse discovers tobacco spittle on the white wall at the back of the school. After closer observation, he discovers it's a 14-year-old girl who is the daughter of one of the school trustees. How in the world would you punish somebody like that? This teacher rides 10 miles a day on horseback to and from school after milking 7 cows in the morning, belonging to the folks he's boarding with. He and his students take on projects such as figuring the capacity of wagon loads of coal, bushels of corn in a grain bin, cubic yards of dirt to be removed for a cellar, and measuring acres to a farm. He and his students went out one day to measure how large a farm was, came up with 48.7 acres, and the surveyor came up with 48.6. They were pretty accurate. After a 5-year break from teaching, Jesse takes on the Winston High School in Tiber Valley. His students here put him to the test. They were almost as smart as he was, and so he had to study long hours. They devoured books one winter afternoon. One winter weekend, he headed toward his home area, 17 miles away, in a blizzard. And he met one of the farmers of the valley, and the farmer told him, he said, I would not do that for my farm. But You'll need a reed to figure out where in the world Jesse spent the night. In the Winston High School, there are a couple of boys who could not play on the same football team because their families had a long-standing feud between them, so they could not play on the same team. Also at that same high school, one day over lunch, he was strolling around the grounds and discovered a couple of boys gambling. And they all turned beet red. The onlookers fled the scene. And he asked me, he said, "So who's winning?" Had everybody in the town talking about the disrespect we have in this school because they're not getting punished for bad things. Had all the support in the end when they finally brought it to a parent-teacher's meeting. Later on, he was a supervisor of the Greenwood County Schools. During that time, the school system faced 32 lawsuits against them. They won 31 of them. Later on, he and his hired driver took a car places that a car had never been before to visit some of the more rural schools. You'll need to read more to find out how the car ended its service to man. Later on, during the Great Depression, Jesse and his co-workers worked without pay, not knowing when or if they would get paid. Now, I know we as teachers are among the highest paid jobs. I don't know if you've ever taught a month or two without being paid. I never have. During that time, the county, the Greenwood County, had a coal bill to pay to a 296-pound coal peddler. And you're going to have to read the book to find out how that bill got paid. Later on, Jesse recommended himself as the principal to the Maxwell High School instead of the county superintendent. His goal as principal here is to eliminate illiteracy in the old and to educate the young. Therefore, his oldest student was 69 years old, affectionately called Grandma. One thing that was a real challenge to me in this book was just the sheer dedication of Jesse. When I get to feeling like I'm kind of overworked and underpaid, Jesse was a great example. If you have not read this book, I highly recommend it. The thread that runs so true, there's a lot of different covers for it. Somebody lent me one that was yellow, this one's blue. So anyway, definitely read it. And by the way, young men, you'll just have to read it and see what happened as far as his marital status.
Instead of using my 6 minutes for one book report, I was able to narrow it down to 6 books that I'd like to suggest. Teaching to Change Lives was very formative for me in the early years of my teaching. And if you need a compelling reason to read it, just look at the subtitle, 7 Proven Ways to Make Your Teaching Come Alive. Teaching to Change Lives by Dr. Howard Hendricks. And then I want to summarize very briefly 2 books by James K. A. Smith, Desiring the Kingdom and You Are What You Love. Both of these books cover similar material, but Desiring the Kingdom is the more scholarly of the two. You Are What You Love is more accessible. However, if you have a stomach for Desiring the Kingdom, there's just a couple real gems in there that make that one maybe preferable in my mind. Here's a quick summary. Smith helps us to think about 2 questions that are absolutely vital for teachers. The one is, what kind of thing is my student? What kind of thing is a human? And a lot of schools tend to see their students as primarily thinkers. Christian schools one up that and see their students as primarily believers. But Smith says that a truly Christian anthropology, that is a truly Christian way of thinking about humans, is to realize that at our core, more than thinkers, more than believers, we are lovers. And that everything we do is shaping the loves of ourselves and each other. By the way, I believe Jesus, when he was asked, what is the most important commandment? And his response is not, you shall believe the right things about God, not, you shall think the right things about God, but you shall love the Lord, is right in line with the thesis of this book. So that's the first question he wrestles with. What kind of thing is my student? The second question then is, if we're primarily lovers, how do you best shape loves? And Smith has helped me to think about the genius of Anabaptism. See, I've always wondered, why is it that we are able as a people to pass on our faith in some remarkably efficient ways, and yet we're not people of developed language and words? He answers it by saying it's not primarily teaching where you pass on loves. It's through practices. And I found this to be one of the most helpful books that I've read as a teacher. He asks a question that I can't just get out of my mind. He says, is it possible that our schools are offering a formation that is actually contradictory to what we are saying is our aim? In other words, we might have these goals as schools, but maybe what we're actually forming in our students is different than what we're saying is our goal for our school. Teachers are leaders. And I know that there are some portions of this book by Oswald Sanders, Spiritual Leadership, that don't apply to all teachers. But there's much here that does. And so I would recommend this for us all as well. Teachers are asked to train the mind of our students in ways that nurture love for God. This book by J.P. Moreland, Love Your God With All Your Mind, helps map the terrain of our work as educators. And finally, Reclaiming the Future of Christian Education. For the last 15 years, I've asked my Foundations of Education students to read this book. And then for the final exam, they are given 2 hours to narrate it. That is, without notes, but just from memory, they are to write what the book is about, and the thesis and the way the book is developed. There's not many books that I've read on education that deserve that kind of immersion, that kind of work, but this one, I believe, does. Those are my 6, but then for good measure, I'll jump on Lyndon's train. And when I had agreed to teach school for the first time, I went to my grandmother, Vera Heatwell was her name, and I said, Grandmother, I've agreed to teach school at our church school. And I said, what recommendations or what advice would you have for me? She said, oh, the only thing I can think of is read The Thread That Runs So True by Jesse Stewart.
Book reports and these short topics are more enjoyable for some than for others. It's really hard to know how to limit your selections. But I've chosen a book that is probably already popular. You maybe already heard it referred to here at this conference today, I suppose. The First Days of School by Harry and Rosemary Wong. 2 different editions here. There is another edition that looks yet the third format, but since I don't have a third hand, or the third book, I didn't hold it up. The First Days of School is copyrighted first in 1991 and multiple times later, most recently in 2009. To date, there are approximately 3.5 million copies of this book floating around. So it's so popular, it almost makes you wonder if something's wrong with it. I don't think there's a whole lot wrong with it, actually. Wong's publications provide tremendous advice for school teachers on the improvement of several key areas of teaching. The one is academic instruction, the quality of teaching. He definitely gives helpful tips, and it's a how-to book on how to improve the quality of your academic instruction. Also, there's a good bit of advice on classroom management. That is, after all, his gig. The type of classroom atmosphere that is most conducive for learning is what we're aiming for. And he perfects that aim. He steadies your aim as you incorporate the ideas that he presents. He also gives advice about teacher expectations of students, the frame of mind a teacher must be in to produce maximum student achievement. He does draw a distinction between classroom management and classroom discipline, makes a rather compelling argument for classroom management as opposed to classroom discipline. The First Days of School is the title of this book. The subtitle is How to Be an Effective Teacher. I'm not sure why exactly the title, The First Days of School, other than that he really does want to make the point that through clear procedures and routines from the very first day, why you can have the kind of behaviors that you need in your classroom. Behaviors that avoid infractions and punishments and ultimately lost productive time in the classroom. So the title, The First Days of School, should not be forgotten, even though he gives a lot of practical how-to tips throughout the book. Right, why you could benefit from this book. It's a book to teachers, from teachers, about teaching. Both Harry and Rosemary Wong, husband and wife team, taught for many years, and their vision in writing this book is to help all teachers jumpstart their school teaching by beginning school successfully. Practically any teacher can open this book anywhere and begin browsing. It is a book that invites grazing or browsing. You don't necessarily have to begin at the first cover. The first cover and read to the back cover. Rather, you can pick it up and look anywhere. But after you've spent some time browsing, you're going to want to read it cover to cover, probably. Be sure you didn't miss anything. So it is a book that invites the extensive examination as well. There's a lot of short blocks, a lot of text boxes and pictures and that type of thing. So you can see that the text is not heavy. There's lots of formatting that would lend itself to tasting here and tasting there and going in for the full course meal. It is a book that inspires teaching. That's why you can benefit from it. It makes a teacher eager to teach, more eager to teach. It has practical suggestions. It has a high view of school and a high view of teaching. The dedication in the front reads, dedicated to my father and mother who wanted me to be a brain surgeon. I exceeded their expectations. I became a scholar and a teacher. You sort of get the idea of where he's coming from. Why you can benefit from the book? Well, it defines in very simple terms the role of a teacher. How can we know what we're supposed to do, much less how to do it, if we don't possess a pretty clear vision of what the teacher is to do and what the teacher is to be? This book has, a very high role of the teacher. The difference in teaching, quoting now, the difference in teacher quality accounts for more than 90% of the variation of student achievement. Did you get that? The difference in teacher quality accounts for more than 90% of the variation in student achievement. The book is laser-focused on both its goal and presentation. There's hardly any extra verbiage. It's 100% on task. Nothing is off topic. And it's also inexpensive. You can go on Amazon and buy them for 99 cents, and plus shipping of $3.99. All right, the remaining time I want to give some real tidbits from this book that have been highlights to me personally. Probably the most used procedure that I've gleaned from this book is the little procedure of give me five. Give me five, meaning, according to the chart behind me in my classroom for years, eyes ready, ears ready, hands ready, be quiet, be still. So a good way to bring your classroom to order, this is a procedure that can be rehearsed on the first day, is give me five. So when there's some students off in left field watching dandelions grow, or whether you're on a field trip, you can call give me five And instantly the ones that are with you will give you five according to procedure only when they're ready with their eyes and their ears and their hands and they're ready to be quiet and be still. And the ones that are off task will soon be pressured into also giving you five. And then you say hands down and you move on. Wonderful way to call a classroom to order. He talks extensively about invitational behaviors using please, name, thank you, smile. So you have a student that's making an annoying tapping and you're trying to have class and you can say, you've got some awesome rhythm there, Trevor, and smile. And if you would please, maybe do that on your leg where it's a bit more quiet so it doesn't annoy some of the rest of us. Thank you. Those kind of things he spells out for you. He talks about the importance of dressing properly and what that communicates. He's able to say some things about dress that even Mennonite pastors are not able to say.